This is The Danglers, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast. One fan's exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band.
Welcome to episode 24 of the Yes Music Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan. Please remember how you can get involved with the podcast on the site at www.yesmusicpodcast.com, where you can subscribe through RSS, via iTunes, by email to the blog post and episode updates. You can read and then comment on show notes or blog posts. You can follow the show on Twitter at Yes Music Podcast, or you can send the show an email, show@yesmusicpodcast.com. You can upload a file via the link on the right-hand side. Leave a voice message and appear on the show yourself in two ways, either by calling 0844 579 6949 using the mailbox number 39417, or by recording a voice message straight onto the website using the record a message button on the extreme right-hand side. If you have a smartphone, then why not download the free Stitcher app and listen to the podcast that way. The European Podcast Awards results were released this week. Unfortunately, we didn't finish in the top 10 for UK personality, and at the time of recording this episode, the top 20 haven't been released. So you never know. I'm just delighted that the podcast was nominated and so many of you took the time and effort to vote. Thank you very much indeed. This week, Stormy Urich from Phoenix, Arizona emailed me several times, which was very kind. I did ask him to explain how I should properly pronounce his surname, but if I've got it wrong, I'm very sorry, Stormy. He made several really helpful suggestions for albums to look at in the future, and I've put those on the list. He also pointed out that I made one of my frequent factual errors right back in the Tales from Topographic Oceans episode. Roger Dean's cats actually walked across one of his paintings for the inside of Yes songs, and not for Tales at all, as I said. Thanks for that correction, Stormy. It's always fantastic to have people like you to point out these things. As I always say, I'm no historian. So this week we're back to talking about a studio album, and this time I've chosen Anderson Bruford Wakeman Howe from 1989. I asked on Twitter this week if the Yes fans out there classed ABWH as a Yes album. The responses were, as you'd expect, split. At Mazardian said, "Technically no, regarding the rights to the Yes name, but I'd prefer ABWH than those without Anderson and Wakeman." Ben Craven replied, "It's not Yes because it's called ABWH. Simple." He continued, "But that suits me because I'm a huge Chris Squire fan." At Electric Freedom answered, "As much as I wish it was, no. I also think it's ruined by Bruford's decision to use awful 80s digital drums." At Wise Old Badger agreed. He said, "Not to my ears. Chris Squire's bass is such an integral part of the Yes sound. ABWH is a good album, but it isn't Yes." At AZ Gizmo, if that's how you pronounce his Twitter handle, pointed out, in a reference to the current lineup perhaps, that it's as much a Yes album as one without John Anderson. However, at Prog and Rock 2020 joined in with, "Distinct possibility, I'd say." At Trekkie 001 was pretty definite. He said, "Yes, of course. Levin for Squire is not a bad shift." Also in agreement was at JJ Delmas. "Yes, for sure. Squireless Yes is as Yes as an Anderson-less Yes, a Wakeman-less Yes, or a Howe-less Yes. What's the difference?" He continues, "And do not get me wrong, if I am trying to learn to play bass, it's largely because of Chris Squire." Enough said. The name was just a legal need. Yes West were at that time legal owners of the Yes trademark, if I am correct. It was fascinating to hear those views. So many thanks to all. Rather than get into a model about the politics of the band at the time, the chronology is that ABWH was released between Big Generator and Union. The personnel on the album would appear to be obvious, Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman and Howe, but all is not quite what it seems. Under the names of the band members in the sleeve notes, we have a rather worrying section entitled "Augmented By." Here we have Tony Levin, the extraordinary bass player and one of the few who could have replaced Chris Squire, Matt Clifford, who apparently was responsible for keyboards, programming, orchestration and vocals, and Milton McDonald, who supplies rhythm guitar. If you've listened to other episodes on this podcast, you'll be expecting me to say that I'm very unhappy with all these additions, and you'd be correct. It makes me wonder how the band, admittedly with the addition of Chris Squire, managed to produce some of the most important music of all time in the early 70s and beyond, on their own. Call me blinkered, call me a naive purist, that's fine. I just want my Yes or Yes-related music to be created and played by the members of the band. I don't think that's too much to ask. There are other bands and artists out there who like to collect musicians for certain projects, for example Peter Gabriel, and that works brilliantly for him. But when you have musicians of the stature of ABW and H, I can't see why you would need any other folk doing orchestrations or playing rhythm guitar. Anyway, rant now officially over. The first track on the album, Themes, is one of four which are split into the traditional numbered parts or movements. This time we have 1 Sound, 2 Second Attention, and 3 Soul Warrior. Sound is labelled in the sleeve notes as instrumental, and all are credited to ABWH, although not in that order. For some reason they are down as AHWB. It opens with a repeating, quiet keyboard pattern with touches of cymbals and guitar, which form a bed of sound underneath Wakeman's piano, which picks out a sequence of notes at different octaves. It sounds as enticing and exciting to me now as it did when I first listened to it in 1989. It has a little of the feel of the opening of Close to the Edge, although this time the soundscape is not at all natural. It's highly electronic, but no less beautiful for me. The calm feel is then abruptly interrupted by Bruford's very electronic-sounding loud drum fill. Bill Bruford is remarkable amongst percussionists of the time, not only because of his championing of the British Simmons Electronic Drum Company, but because of his almost unique ability to make the fairly primitive instruments sound musical and blend in with other musicians, and ABWH is no exception. Despite being obviously electronic, the sounds he chooses and the way he integrates them into the band makes them complementary rather than jarring, as they certainly are elsewhere in the music of the same vintage. Even in this opening salvo from Bruford, we know we're going to have something very different from him to his early work with Yes. With the entry of Bruford and then the rest of the instrumentalists, we move straight into part 2, Second Attention, and we hear both Anderson and the bass notes of Tony Levin. Anderson is on fine form, soaring over the top of the sparkling, high-energy accompaniment, with an insistent line and lyrics in the old-fashioned style, by which I mean I'm really not sure what he's on about. He's certainly attacking some force or entity, and this is shown in his almost aggressive delivery, but I'm not sure what an ever-piercing power play machine is. If you know, drop me a line. Anyway, the music is fabulous, there's plenty going on, and it sounds like an elaborate fiesta. Perhaps it's meant to portray the feeling of excitement the long-lost brothers are feeling at being back together making music again. My only slight reservation is the bass line. I'm just left wondering what Chris Squire could have made of it. It seems a bit low and muddy for me, whereas I think Squire could have added some more of a creative edge. The vocal section is quite short, and then we are treated to an expansive Wakeman sequence, with Howe and Bruford trying to outdo each other in complexity in the accompaniment. Once again, I'm not entirely sure where part 3 Soul Warrior begins, but there are sections of Howe Wakeman sparring in integrated fashion, with Bruford adding military-inspired electronic snare drum parts. The music rolls along in fascinating style with huge momentum, and then segues into the next track, Fist of Fire. Pretty much everything about the opening of Fist of Fire is heavy. The beat, the keyboard chords, the whole feel. Wakeman uses some dark runs and Bruford holds everything together with an insistent driving rhythm. Listen out for a great bit of word painting when Anderson says, "Surely you can fly," and Steve Howe soars upwards in imitation. It feels like you're immersed in a threatening landscape. There's a real sense of impending doom. Anderson starts to turn the corner in classic style in the battle between dark and light when he talks about not being afraid, and the mood starts to turn lighter with Wakeman leading the way with a brighter tone and feel. Suddenly it becomes clear this is a song about light overcoming darkness, as positive, massive chords underpin Howe's soaring guitar and Anderson's vocals catapult us out of doom and into the light that only this kind of music with these musicians can create. It's order out of chaos time again, and handled beautifully. The song may be short, but the adrenaline rush is on an epic scale. This is definitely a track to play very loudly with your eyes closed, and I encourage you to do so. Brother of Mine is the second track, which is split up into sections. We have 1, The Big Dream, 2, Nothing Can Come Between Us, and 3, Long Lost Brother of Mine. The Big Dream starts in quasi-oriental style, with something which sounds like an orchestral gong, or I think more accurately a tam-tam. For those who are interested in this kind of minutiae, I have put a link in the show notes to help you distinguish between the two percussion instruments. I imagine that this sound is actually produced by Bruford on his trusty Simmons SDX electronic drum kit, however. Maybe he's also responsible for what sounds like an oriental stringed instrument, which joins the tam-tam. Anderson begins the piece with one of his slow, uplifting themes, a little reminiscent of the mood of Soon. This is an introduction to the next section, which features a lovely Howe electric solo to introduce Anderson vocals above an interesting full-band texture, including quite an explorative bass line, although I'm sure Squire would have made sure it was higher in the mix. This is definitely a song, with verses, bridge, chorus, and so on. However, it's a beautifully crafted song with amazingly complex accompaniment, showcasing both Howe and Wakeman's dexterous virtuosity. Part 2, Nothing Can Become Between Us, begins without warning, and in fact, if you were to analyse the first two parts of the song, there are some very clear developments of the material which make the two distinct parts flow seamlessly and build on one another as the mood increases in excitement. This is pure prog rock in form, if not necessarily classic Yes in sound. This song embodies the feeling we were all expecting to find on Union, a coming together of long-lost brothers to create works of great progressive rock synthesis. This time it seems to be working. Howe launches into a huge, powerful solo as we approach part 3, Long Lost Brother of Mine. A fascinating feature of this part of the suite is that it is credited to Anderson, Howe, Wakeman, Bruford, and Downes. Wakeman and Downes. I think it's safe to assume that they didn't sit in a room together and pen this song. The instrumental introduction to the chorus of this section is a fascinating mixture of the musicians clearly trying to outdo one another again in energy and creativity. It produces a whirling maelstrom of sound as it flies by. Now then, the chorus. I fully support the sentiment of the lyrics. It's an uplifting, toe-tapper of a tune, but I'm sitting here trying to decide if it does actually tip me over the edge into embarrassing cringing. The synthesized hand claps don't help. Maybe they seemed like a good idea at the time. When the interspersed instrumental sections arrive, they work well, both as a contrast and in their own right, with great playing from the band. There's also a slower section of poise and integrity. It's just the actual chorus. Even Wakeman's keyboard countermelody sounds a bit contrived. I really want to like it, but in the end I do still feel a bit uncomfortable listening to it. I definitely wouldn't play this chorus to the uninitiated as an introduction to the album. There's a creative and interesting ending, with rapidly rising lines crescendoing to a climax, and we are on to Birthright. Interestingly, the sleeve notes tell the story of the song very specifically, about nuclear testing in Australia. So get set for Aboriginal sounds. In fact, they are integrated really well. This track doesn't sound at all contrived. The opening woody, natural percussion sounds are complemented by Howe on classical guitar, and the overall effect of the rhythm and feel is mystery and maybe even sadness. Anderson's vocals take up the story. There's very effective word painting as Anderson declaims the situation at high pitch, with Howe adding interjections of dirty, loud, heavy electric guitar. It's powerful and moving. The vocal line includes some deliberate suspension, by which I mean Anderson sings notes which are not in the same chord as the rest of the band, to emphasise the pain and suffering of the people affected by the testing. This is a common technique, particularly in sacred vocal music, but is usually, certainly in older music, resolved, with the notes coming back together into the same chord. Here Anderson deliberately leaves them unresolved to heighten the mood. It's very effective. At about 3 minutes and 5 seconds, the music breaks down and the pulse disappears for a section of improvised-sounding explorative lines. After this interlude, a rhythm is set up again and Wakeman plays some of the fastest lines ever in short bursts of sound. Then we are treated to one of those Yes moments of clarity, an uplifting and affirming passage led by Anderson, reminding us we can overcome all obstacles by love and understanding. It's a musical and thematic rush, fantastic arrangement and playing. The end breaks down again, leaving Anderson calling out phrases in what I imagine is an Aboriginal language, to the accompaniment of didgeridoos. This time it's all handled very well, and it sounds like a sensitive integration of elements, rather than a banal attempt to graft world music into a Yes song. I find Birthright an exhilarating, rewarding and immersive experience. The opening of The Meeting walks the tightrope for me again between M.O.R. and Simple Beauty. Rick Wakeman's keyboards and then piano set the scene, but it's a little too close to Richard Clayderman for my comfort, a little bit too daytime TV movie soundtrack. When Anderson comes in with the melody, my opinion changes. The vocal line has a lovely shape and feel. It's in the naive school of Anderson compositions, and a very successful one. Here we have Anderson and Wakeman foreshadowing their live and recorded collaborations of recent years. It's a great combination. The song is credited to the whole band, but I really don't see what the rest did here. It's like an oasis of calm and beauty in the middle of the album. The next track is the second to have multiple named sections, Quartet. As several times before in Yes Music, here we have a term borrowed from classical music. Perhaps it's referring to the four sections of the suite, or maybe it's the four musicians in the band, or maybe it's a blend of the two. Anyway, the first part is called I Want to Learn More About You and is credited to the whole quartet. It starts with a pleasing multi-layered guitar and mandolin introduction with a lovely melodic feel. The vocals appear in relaxed style with well-formed harmonies. I have to say that the use of shortened words and bad grammar irritates me in this song. I can't see why it would be necessary to use wanna instead of wanted to, and we haven't spoke instead of we haven't spoken. It's not down to the music. The correct alternatives could be fitted into the vocal lines. Of course, I am guilty of double standards here, as I have never complained about I Wanna Hold Your Hand. I'm a bundle of contradictions. Just ignore me if you think I'm too touchy about this, maybe I am. But it still puts me off what is otherwise a lovely opening. The pitch of the vocal line is carefully engineered to accentuate the motion of the song, starting low and soft and then building the mood up with a higher line in the third verse. The fourth verse is a recap of the original melody, and the resulting shape of the song is very effective at creating the mood. There's nothing progressive about the quartet yet, but this is a well-constructed opening section with more than a hint of classic Anderson spirituality in the subject matter and the music. The opening material is repeated at the end with an imitation of a Squire bass line reaching further and further up the range of the instrument. This is good to hear, but the tone of the bass makes me wonder if it's actually a synthesized line, which would be sacrilege to me. The movement segues into two, She Gives Me Love, with the bass line and other parts providing some effective bridging, and the bass continuing to imitate a Squire line. This song is more up-tempo, and Wakeman adds a trumpet-type solo to the jaunty, drum-infused rhythm. This is a very, very clever song. Not only does it feature Anderson backing vocals in imitation of the kind of sound he produced for We Have Heaven or Soon, the lyrics also make references to old Yes songs. I don't need to mention them, just listen and you'll pick them all up. And in fact, the Soon melody is used by the backing choir here. It will seep into your consciousness, even if you're not aware of it. I think it's actually very well done, and not cloying or contrived at all. It comes over as an homage to the band's past, rather than an attempt to make an artificial link to help bolster the credibility of the album. After all, these were the guys who created the masterworks mentioned. Yes, I know you could analyse it and say, but there's no Chris Squire, and Wakeman didn't play on Relayer, and so on, but in the context of this music, I think it works really well. Rick Wakeman's soloing is fascinating. There's a variation on the vocal theme, and then towards the end he goes into magical-esque mode, recalling his work on Tormato, and then adding an oboe voice. For me, this categorically doesn't descend into pastiche. It's great fun spotting all the references, and a hugely enjoyable listen. Part 3 is Who Was the First? This part fits perfectly with the preceding mood, and is also a kind of extension of it. There's an obvious and wide-ranging bass line, which could almost have been written by Squire again, but again, definitely not played by him, as the tone is completely different. Wakeman preserves some of the sound of the previous track, and it jogs along in pleasing fashion. Anderson's vocals are particularly good here at high pitch, contrasted by a set of real backing singers, not the Yes Choir, and some elaborate counter-melodies from Wakeman. Again, it's uplifting and pleasant music. The backing singers make it sound a bit M.O.R., as does the lightness of tone in the accompaniment. Overall, it's a bit of a lightweight song, to be honest. There's a definite break before part 4, I'm Alive. Here we have a fascinating example of what orchestration on Magnification could have been like, if Wakeman had been engaged. The synthesized violin solo is a fantastic piece of work, and lifts the song to a new level. Of course, this could have been Matt Clifford, not Wakeman at all, as you can see on the sleeve notes, and you'll have to excuse me for getting frustrated by this possibility. I'd really like this to be Wakeman, and not someone I've never heard of, drafted in for the purpose. Anyway, it's another beautiful song, with a great contrast between sections, at times uplifting and affirmative, at times a little melancholic, but all perfectly handled, and rounded off with some exquisite keyboard work. This is not a prog rock epic, but rather a set of connected songs which work really well together, and that's just fine by me. Next up is Tiquepoix, subtitled The Life and Times of Bobby Dread. To be honest, when I looked at the sleeve notes for this track while preparing this episode, it was the first time I'd noticed this odd subtitle. Unusually for me, I did a quick Google search to find out what it was all about. Apparently, this is the name John Anderson used to use for booking into hotels, so perhaps this is a bit of an autobiographical song. It's in a pseudo-calypso-Caribbean style. This is one of those songs that I find difficult to make up my mind about. On the one hand, it's a fiesta of fun, and very well performed and arranged. On the other hand, it's unlike any other song I can think of in the Yes canon, and I'm not necessarily convinced I want it on this ABWH album. The opening section features a very catchy tune on keyboards amid a wild frenzy of sound effects and complex party-style rhythms. Steve Howe's acoustic guitar is particularly effective at portraying the mood as it weaves in and out of the keyboard lines, along with Anderson's high-energy vocal interjections. Anderson's vocal line is doubled by keyboard and in fact repeats the catchy theme of the opening. In its own terms, this song works very well. There's even an uplifting key shift to make the sense of play and calypso even more engaging. Just before 3 minutes, the mood changes to a calmer feel as Anderson sings high melodic lines above a low, almost growling chorus of Bobby Dread and the Cool Running, cool spelled with a K. The music shifts up several times and it builds up somewhat while repeating the same material. Then there's a kind of wordless refrain followed by a breakdown into a Bill Bruford rhythmical Caribbean fantasy beneath Anderson and some backing singers producing a playful arrangement of fragments above. The variety produced by these sections really saves the song for me, as there's quite a bit of interesting contrast and arrangement here, which make the reintroduction of the fast material not as one-dimensional as it could have been. Wakeman adds a section of fast running lines and chords, which seem to fight each other, and Bruford's drumming, for prominence, and the track fades out. Order of the Universe is the final piece, which is split up into sections. One order theme is an instrumental credited to the whole band. Another great piece of arrangement, it's Rick Wakeman who introduces this particular theme after a complex texture of percussion and guitar is set up to accompany it. It turns out to be expansive with long lines to contrast with the much more frenetic activity of the accompaniment. I'm not completely convinced that I like this particular keyboard sound, but it's well integrated here. Howe doubles the theme next on typical soaring electric guitar, and it's all really quite progressive in feel. It's certainly given plenty of time to develop and grow without worrying about moving on too quickly to more recognisable song structure elements, and this is refreshing to see. At about 2 minutes 50 seconds, the real backing choir appear, rather than the Yes choir once again. I would perhaps prefer to hear the Yes choir, but this bunch acquit themselves well. I just have a sneaking suspicion that it's easier to get a professional choir in rather than taking the time to overlay individual vocal tracks of the band members. Maybe the absence of Squire made this decision easier to come to. It reminds me a bit of the live Queen shows since Freddie Mercury died, at which entire gospel choirs of backing singers are employed to reproduce the masterpieces of studio overdubbing in songs like Somebody to Love. It's Queen, but not as we know it. Maybe ABWH is Yes, but not as we know it. Anyway, it is a backing choir, and they repeat the Order of the Universe several times before Anderson blasts in with a quite uncharacteristically strident vocal line. I imagine this all marks the beginning of part two, Rock Gives Change, which also adds Rhett Lawrence to the writing credits in addition to the band members. It's an up-tempo song with a clearly defined structure. Verses give way to a bridge which effectively builds the tension until a release at the chorus. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and the song develops very pleasingly from the material of the first section. All the band members sound fully committed to this medium-paced rock section, and it's highly effective music, which I think owes quite a bit to the 90125 big generator mode of writing and performance. It's interesting to hear Steve Howe in more of an Asia role here than a 70s-era Yes role. He is, of course, a master of both. While I'm musing on this section, the music moves imperceptibly into part three, It's So Hard to Grow, using the same feel and motion as the previous part. Another strong bridge section brings us to a reprise of The Order of the Universe, which is repeated several times in a kind of rabble-rousing chant. This is clearly music designed for the stadium rather than the concert hall, and as such it's very successful, showing that anything Rabin and the Yes West crew could do, this band could also manage. There's a section of Bruford's electronic drumming around 7 minutes 25 seconds, which is guaranteed to annoy the likes of Fat Electric Freedom again with its 80s synthetic sounds. And this is followed by recaps of themes on keyboard, and then the track fades out to leave tinkling chimes and synthesized tam-tam. I've no idea where the last section, 5, The Universe, starts, but I'm not really sure it matters. The suite fits together very well indeed and features just enough progressive elements to keep me happy. The last track, Let's Pretend, begins while the last part of The Universe fades. It's an epilogue, as we have seen on previous Yes albums, and lasts for a total of 2 minutes and 56 seconds. A fascinating fact about this track is that previous Anderson collaborator and keyboard wizard Vangelis is given writing credits along with ABW and H, so even if he never made it into Yes as a member, at least his name appears here on the closest album to Yes that exists. You can research that one at your leisure. It's a combination of typically beautiful Steve Howe acoustic guitar accompaniment, typically airy John Anderson vocals, and typically understated Wakeman washes of keyboards. If you can excuse the somewhat bizarre Anderson lyrics and take it as what I think it's supposed to be, a simple song about the power of love, people and nature, then I'm sure you will enjoy it as much as I do. So overall then, this album works brilliantly as a whole. There's a real sense of progression and strength in its structure. It's one of those creations that I can't see working with a different order of tracks, or with some left out. This is quite remarkable for such a long album, and a testament to the musicians. While I'm not a huge fan of every note, this is definitely one of the albums I enjoy most when I have the time to sit down and listen to it in its entirety. Is it Yes? Well, I think it's as close as you can get without Chris Squire, and I've included it on the Yes Music podcast because had things been different legally, I'm sure it would have been called a Yes album. I'd love to have had Squire adding his unique bass lines, but as it stands, it's still a great album for me. So that's about it for this week. Next week is still a mystery to me. I haven't decided yet exactly what the episode will be about, but rest assured that it will involve the greatest progressive rock band of all time. In the meantime, please get involved at www.yesmusicpodcast.com, on Twitter at Yes Music Podcast, by sending an email to show@yesmusicpodcast.com, by uploading a file or recording a voice message via the site, or by leaving a voicemail on 0844 579 6949 using the mailbox number 39417. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.